Our first scripture reading today is a familiar story from Exodus chapter 3. Moses was taking care of the flock for his father-in-law Jethro, Midian's priest. He led his flock out to the edge of the desert and he came to God's mountain called Horeb. The Lord's messenger appeared to him in a flame of fire in the middle of a bush. Moses saw that the bush was in flames, but it didn't burn up. Then Moses said to himself, "Let me check out this amazing sight and find out why the bush isn't burning up." When the Lord saw that he was coming to look, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." Moses said, "I'm here." And then the Lord said, "Don't come any closer. Take off your sandals, because you are standing on holy ground." He continued, "I am the God of your father, Abraham's God, Isaac's God, Jacob's God." Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And then the Lord said, "I've clearly seen my people oppressed in Egypt. I've heard their cry of injustice because of their slave masters. I know about their pain. I've come down to rescue them from the Egyptians in order to take them out of that land and bring them to a good and broad land, a land that's full of milk and honey. So get going. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I to go to Pharaoh and to bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I'll be with you. And this will show you that I'm the one who sent you. After you bring the people out of Egypt, you will come back here and worship me on this mountain." But Moses said to God, "If I now come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' they're going to ask me, 'What's this God's name?' What am I supposed to say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. So say to the Israelites, 'I am has sent me to you.'" God continued, "Say to the Israelites, 'The Lord, the God of your ancestors, Abraham's God, Isaac's God, Jacob's God, has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is how all generations will remember me.'" And another familiar story, this from the Gospel of Mark. Jesus took Peter, James, and John and brought them to the top of a very high mountain where they were alone. Jesus was transformed in front of them, and his clothes were amazingly bright, brighter than if they had been bleached white. Elijah and Moses appeared and were talking with Jesus. Peter reacted to all of this by saying to Jesus, "Rabbi, it's good that we are here. Let us make three shrines, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." He said this because he didn't know how to respond, for the three of them were terrified. And then a cloud overshadowed them, and a voice spoke from the cloud, "This is my son, whom I dearly love. Listen to him." And suddenly, looking around, they no longer saw anyone with them except Jesus. On the nightly news, I'm left speechless by the pictures of California's wildfires. I can't comprehend the vastness of grasslands and woodlands burning out of control. The flames advance without heed to barriers like roads and rivers and hills and valleys and much less property lines. A resident returned to her home the other day to find nothing remaining but a fireplace chimney and a 6-inch layer of ash where her home used to be. Total devastation. It's what we would expect from a brush fire. Which is why Moses was puzzled upon encountering a bush on fire that was not being consumed by the flame. I remember a seminary professor suggesting that the burning bush was God's test. Was Moses attentive enough to notice that the flames weren't destroying this bush? Well, indeed, Moses did notice, and when a voice spoke to him from the bush, Moses understood that he was encountering God. In ancient times, everyone understood that fire was conceived to be a form of the divine appearance. Well, Moses replied to the voice from the flames, "Here I am." And that's when the voice of God stopped him in his tracks. "Take off your sandals. You are on holy ground." Holy ground? A patch of sandy, rocky soil on a mountainside? That's certainly not what we picture when we think of holy ground. I mean, different people imagine different places as holy ground. I mean, right here in the sanctuary of this church is an area that many of you probably regard as holy ground. I know that many of you never walk up the four steps from the main floor to this stage called the chancel. This raised platform holds the communion table, the pulpit, the baptismal font, the cross, the choir loft. You might regard this as sacred space reserved for those who lead the worship service. You regard this area as holy ground. And then for some people, the solemn memorial at the USS Arizona, honoring the servicemen and women killed at Pearl Harbor. That soul-stirring memory of tragedy and loss, that is an experience of holy ground. Others experience those feelings as they walk through Gettysburg's battlefields, or the American Cemetery and Memorial perched on a bluff overlooking Omaha Beach in Normandy, France. A different kind of holy ground is experienced by some who travel to rural Iowa to experience that baseball field made famous in the motion picture Field of Dreams. They feel a profound connection with the spirit of the game that they appreciate as the embodiment of all that is good in America. Others have that holy ground feeling toward the horseshoe on the campus of The Ohio State University, feeling a connection with their alma mater perhaps, or simply pride in being an Ohioan. When you travel with me on my next trip to the Holy Land, you may be like many Holy Land pilgrims who sense that they're on holy ground walking through Jerusalem. In particular, the city's ancient Church of the Holy Sepulchre contains very, very old chapels and monuments to the crucifixion and the burial of Jesus. Millions of Christian tourists and pilgrims go there every year to see and experience the holy ground where Jesus walked the final minutes of his earthly life. For me, however, the strongest sense of holy ground in the Holy Land was, ironically, while we were on a boat cruising on the waters of the Sea of Galilee. You see, most land-based sites of biblical events have been buried under meters of dirt and rubble by centuries of civilization. But out on the waters of the Sea of Galilee, I could look around at the shore and the hills and realize that Jesus had looked upon this same panorama. I felt a keen connection with Jesus as I sailed on that watery, holy ground. Special places and spaces can evoke a sense of being on holy ground. Perhaps it's the cottage that your family had as a getaway when you were a child. Maybe it's the grave of a dear one. Maybe where you met your life's partner feels like holy ground whenever you think of it. Celtic spirituality uses the term thin places to describe an encounter with the holy in a particular place or situation. Thin places are locales where the distance between heaven and earth collapses, and we're able to catch glimpses of the divine, of the transcendent. When Jesus took Peter, James, and John away from the other disciples for a brief mountaintop retreat, they had a stunning experience. Jesus was transfigured. His appearance changed right before their very eyes. Matthew's gospel reports that Jesus' face shimmered. His garments glowed with a brightness that the strongest bleach could not achieve. And not only that, but Moses and Elijah suddenly appeared with Jesus. The three engaged intently in conversation. I bet that's the last thing the three disciples expected from this little outing with Jesus. Bible scholars believe that the story is intended to signal that Jesus will rise from death to new life. But witnessing that indescribable event, being in that thin place, that delicate moment of intense revelation, the disciples didn't know what to do. Feebly, Peter suggested that they carry out a Jewish harvest tradition, erecting three little shrines to mark the occasion. But before they could even begin, they were stopped when God's voice sounded from heaven, telling the disciples to listen to his own dear son. The message? There was nothing the disciples could do to make that moment holier than it already was. How might we encounter thin places in our daily lives? The reality is that our daily responsibilities may press us to rush through our days without taking time to notice the holy ground around us and to appreciate it and to respond to God's presence in it. After all, there are so many things to distract us. Our health concerns may occupy our thoughts with or without a pandemic. Our children's needs seem to take every waking hour. The peculiar pressures of the workplace right now eat up our time and energy as we try to figure out new ways of operating. Our society is experiencing labor pains as we try to give birth to a new norm of respect for all people, not simply for the majority. And our eyes and ears are filled with the messages of political campaigns. Yes, there are many things that can deny us the time and patience and peace to be able to look for and listen for thin places, to notice signs of holy ground. We may discover that what we presume to be ordinary can be holy ground when we try to view what's before us as God would see it. That's how a pastor named Vince Amlin came to understand that the ground that he was standing on was indeed holy ground, although it didn't seem like it at first blush. You see, when Vince was in seminary, he interned at a Mennonite church in the city of Chicago. He described the congregation occupying a corner storefront in a rougher neighborhood of Chicago. He said, "A couple of weeks after I started, I came into worship to find one of the large plate glass windows in the sanctuary boarded up. Someone had thrown a rock through it." Well, the congregation took it in stride. Little plywood, little duct tape, call for repair, and it was good as new. Then a week later, another rock. I got upset. This was the room where VBS gathered to sing songs and play games. It was the room where neighborhood kids showed up for our potlucks, even though they had no food to share, and so I was running out to buy pizzas at the last minute. This was the room where we worshiped God, sacred space, holy ground. But no one in the storefront Mennonite church seemed to share my indignation. And then I remembered how the congregation had come to worship in that place. 10 years before, he said, a small group had gathered to pray at that intersection after a drive-by shooting. And they prayed there every week until that building came up for sale. Their sacred space had not been violated by the troubled neighborhood, as I assumed. They had claimed that space as sacred because it was troubled. They had eyes to see holy ground shining through the brokenness of the neighborhood. As we heard from Scripture today, God graced Moses with the chance to see the flame and feel the heat and hear God's voice. God graced the three disciples with the opportunity to see their master continuing the line of service to God's people previously borne by Moses, the leader, and Elijah, the prophet. God has given us eyes to see holy ground in the paths of our day as well. God's presence in our lives in Jesus Christ puts us in the middle of holy ground. And as the disciples learned when they saw their master joined with Moses and Elijah, when we sense God's intimate presence in our lives, we may not need to do anything. Encountering holy ground is a gift of God's grace, reminding us that our lives unfold within the care of God's constant and compassionate love. May it be so.